you don't hear none of those stations playing them, ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org, and we're at iTunes under radio, and then you click on KUCI and you can tune right in. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing, as usual, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we are fortunate to have with us Melissa Faye Green. She'll be with us for the entire hour. She's a contributor to the New York Times Magazine and Good Housekeeping. She also writes for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Reader's Digest, Newsweek, Life, The Washington Post, Ms., and Parenting. She's here today to talk about her most recent book, There Is No Me Without You, One Woman's Odyssey to Rescue Her Country's Children, published by Bloomsbury. She has other books out. Last Man Out was published by Harcourt in 2003. It's the story of the 1958 mine disaster in Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, and it was one of the world's first televised disasters. The book was a New York Times notable book and was named one of the best books of the year by the Chicago Tribune, the Toronto Globe and Mail, the Cox newspaper chain, and the New York Public Library. Before that, her second book was also an award winner, Temple Bombing, came out in 1996. It was about the attack on an Atlanta synagogue in October 1958. She has other books as well. And again, as I said, we're going to talk today about There's No Me Without You, published by Bloomsbury. And let's bring her on. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. Good to have you with us.
Good.
Will you talk a little bit about how There Is No Me Without You came about?
Sure. It's writing about orphan children in Ethiopia was far beyond anything I ever thought about doing. My three earlier books were all different events, kind of in modern Southern history, they were literary, nonfiction. But it happens that my family is interested in adoption. My husband and I have four children by birth, and when the oldest, Molly, suddenly grew up and left home for college, we were devastated. And with just three children at home, we had a feeling of empty nest panic. So we kind of thought we'd just look into adoption. And it seems if you start looking into adoption, it's very hard to ever turn away. What I discovered at my very first glimpse into adoption using whatever the internet search engine was then, 99, was that thousands of photographs of children waiting in orphanages around the world were posted on the internet. So we ended up bringing home a 4.5-year-old boy from Bulgaria. Then a couple of years later, our next oldest child suddenly grew up and was about to leave home for college, and we had that familiar feeling of emptiness panic again. We've just you know, loved having the kids underfoot. But at that moment, the newspapers were full of grim headlines about the toll HIV/AIDS was taking on Africa. Millions of people were perishing, most of them young adults, and they were leaving behind children. So with our, you know, kind of interest in adoption again, coupled with these terrible headlines and the news that the United Nations was referring to Africa as a continent of children because the whole generation of adults was getting wiped out, I wondered if you could adopt from Africa. So my first step into the world of these children was not as a journalist or at all with the idea of writing about them, but was as a prospective adoptive mother. Our family was matched with a 5.5-year-old girl named Helen who had lost both her parents to AIDS. She was healthy. She was alone in the world and adorable. I first flew to Ethiopia in 2001. I'm a regular contributor to the New York Times magazine. So before going, I asked my editors there if I might do something for them about the AIDS orphan crisis, and they said, sure. So I was able on that trip both to meet Helen and to do the research for a story that the New York Times Magazine published about a year later called What Will Happen to Africa's AIDS Orphans. Am I going on too long?
No, go ahead.
Should I keep going?
Keep going.
I felt very sheepish about writing the story because I'm not a doctor, I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not a demographer, I'm not any of those types of specialists that would seem to have something to say about the AIDS orphan crisis, but I could talk about what I was seeing. I knew what was in front of me. So I was kind of swept away by the response to that article. There was just a huge response to that article, and before it was published, I was telling people that I was able to write this article because I actually knew epidemiologists, because we live near CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and we carpool to soccer with epidemiologists, and because I can pronounce the word epidemiologist. These were my credentials. But there was such a terrific response to that article, including my being invited to speak to a group within the World Bank, and my being invited actually to speak to a group of epidemiologists at CDC. And I approached both groups saying, me? You want me to talk to you? You know, you're the ones with all the data. But what I heard from the epidemiologists was that they were sort of up to their eyeballs in data, and it was useful for them just to hear stories from the front lines and just hear stories about individual children. I mention in the book the observation that it's not possible for any human being to process 25 million bits of information. The news that there are 25 million or 35 million or 45 million orphaned children in Africa, you just can't care about numbers like that. But you can care a lot about one or two or three. It's just human nature. So my book is really more about the one or two or three set against this mind-boggling crisis.
And your book focuses on a woman who started a compound taking in orphans.
I met during one of my trips to Ethiopia. We ended up adopting a second child a couple of years later, named Fisaha, a 10-year-old boy. And then this past June, two more Ethiopian boys, ages 10 and 13. But we are more than finished now. We were finished for the last two. Heard about Mrs. Haraguin Tefera and then was able to meet her. Some of the things that drew me to her was the fact that she was an educated middle-class woman. She was an accountant. She'd worked for Addis Ababa University. Her husband had been a high school biology teacher and principal. She had lost him to a heart attack. So this was a middle-class family. They had a washing machine, two cars, you know, spent the evenings reading and listening to classical music. Already, it's not the cliches of Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Usually, if Ethiopia is in the news, it's because someone is starving, or someone is a supermodel, or someone has just won a gold medal in the 10,000 meters in the Olympics. You know, there's just a few basic stories about Ethiopia in the news. So it was just, you know, she's not fast. She's kind of short and round and not a supermodel, just a person, you know. She and her husband had two daughters after her husband's death. Heroin raised the daughters to young adulthood by herself. The oldest daughter, Atetageb, who was a graduate of Addis Ababa University and who worked for the World Food Program, got sick. Her mother, Heroin, was at that moment living in Cairo, Egypt, working for the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and she got a phone call one day from Atetageb, and Atetageb said, "Mother, I'm sick." Heroin flew home to Addis and found her beautiful daughter on her deathbed. Atetageb was gaunt, covered with sores, losing her sight, losing her hair. And Heroin said, "What? Why didn't you tell me?" And Atetageb said, "I didn't want you to suffer." Heroin spent the next 8 months trying to save her daughter, and Atetageb was the mother of an infant boy. Again, middle-class family. So Heroin consulted every clinic, every doctor, every hospital, but the medicine did not exist in Ethiopia that could have saved Atetageb. It existed in the West, but it had not made it to Africa. And after 8 months, Atetageb died, basically, in her mother's arms. Heroin's life stopped. She was then in her early 50s. She did not go back to work. She did not go back to Cairo. Every day she got up, dressed all in black, drove or walked to the graveyard, and spent the day praying by Atetageb's grave. On the way home in the evening, she'd stop off at a church to pray. She's Ethiopian Orthodox, a Coptic church, but she said she felt that all churches led to God. So she would stop sometimes at the Catholic church, at a Baptist church. A year went by like this. During this year, she one day typed out a line from a song that she liked, and the song was, the line was, "There is no me without you." And she cut it out and put it over her daughter's picture. That's where the title of the book comes from. Her friends sometimes would see her and say, "Heroin, what's going on with you? We never see you. You know, come for coffee, or are you coming back to work?" And Heroin could not even meet their eyes. She would just look down and say, but my daughter, I liked her very much." After 18 months of living like this, she asked the Ethiopian Orthodox Church to allow her to leave the world, to take her into seclusion. And she would live in a hut by her daughter's grave and spend the rest of her life there, was her plan. But just at that moment, a Catholic aid organization, who knew her from praying at their church, approached her and said, "Oh, Mrs. Heroin, we were about to ask you a favor. What can I do for the church? I'm not even Catholic." They said, "Well, there's a 15-year-old girl who's ended up on our steps. She was dumped on our steps. We think she was raped. She's got no one. She has no home to go to." And Heroin said, "Why do you tell me this?" They said, "Would you take her? Could you take this girl?" And Heroin said, "Well, my life is over, but if you think God needs me to take this girl for a while, I'll do that." So she took this girl. 2 weeks later, the Catholic group called again. They said, "Mrs. Heroin, we now have a 17-year-old boy. He's got nothing. He's got no one. You know, would you take him?" Again, she said, "My life's over, but if this is what God wants, I'll take the boy." 2 weeks later, the group called again. Now Heroin said, "No, no, no, no. The teenagers are about to kill me. I'm, you know, no more." But the Catholic aid group said, "Well, we have two little girls, two six-year-old girls. They have nothing. They've lost everything. You know, could you take them?" And Heroin again said, "Well, my life is over, but if God needs me to take these children, I'll take them." From the moment she took these two six-year-old girls, she never again said, "My life is over." She truly began to come back to life. With the arrival of these little girls, suddenly she felt herself to be just a middle-aged mother with children again. So she's now meeting teachers and buying school supplies. Now her friends and her surviving daughter are in a panic that she's done this thing. It's one thing to take in the teenagers because her husband was a high school principal. You know, you'd want to reach out to teenagers. Mm-hmm. But these little girls were clearly orphans of AIDS. Whether or not they were HIV positive was beside the point. The fear and lack of knowledge about the disease was so intense that people shied away even from the orphan children, that they must carry the disease, or that if the parents died of the disease because they were sinners, then the sin is visited on the children. Mm-hmm. So there was these children, nobody wanted to touch them. But Heroin said, what could stigma possibly mean to me now? Plus, she didn't even care about living, so she was not afraid of the children. Then the Catholic Church called again. Now Harrigan said, all right, listen, my bad, I should have called you, I should have called to thank you. You did just the right thing for me, because she still thinks this is all about her, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is just what I needed, you know, this is just what the doctor ordered, these little girls, you were right, I did not need to be going into seclusion, this was really great, and you know, it's all good, thank you, see you around. But the Catholic group said, well, Mrs. Harrigan, we have four children here now, we have twin four-year-old girls, a seven-year-old girl, and an eight-year-old boy. And Harrigan said, oh, and you need me to take one of them? How do you choose among orphans? And the Catholic chief said, well, no, Mrs. Harrigan, we need you to take all the children. And Harrigan said, well, why can't you ask someone else? And he said, well, there is no one else. Just at that moment in time, there was no one else to ask. So she, of course, took those four children, and all of that was about, you know, 400 or 500 children ago. So that's, you know, she is my path into this story.
Mm. That is so moving. Such, I think it's the most moving story anybody's ever told about how they found their way to a book.
And
I'm talking with Melissa Fay Green. Her book is There Is No Me Without You, published by Bloomsbury. Would you read a little bit to us from the book?
Sure. Let's read. Do you want something light or something a little darker? Well, we're in sort of a low mood.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's go with this one. Although this particular story will have a happy ending.
Okay.
I'll read and then just tell me, Barbara, when I should stop. In one of the poorest neighborhoods of Addis Ababa lived a destitute girl with a tiny, bald, discontented baby. Now, I should say a lot of the book involves the stories of children who end up in Harrigan's courtyard. So this is going to be one of these children. The girl wrapped herself and the thin baby in a shawl and slept on whatever mud floor they were pityingly offered. Sometimes they were given a piece of plastic to spread beneath them as a sheet. Rain filtered through the gaps between the mud wall and the tin roof. By day, the girl begged in the streets. She spent every coin instantly trying to feed herself. When the owners of the shanty realized she would contribute nothing to the household, they asked her to move on. She was too thin and hungry to produce enough milk to nurse the baby, who seemed always to be disappointed and angry. When he turned his head away from her chest and screamed in frustration, his face turned beet black, and his eyes bulged, and he raved with his small fists. Even when she managed to squeeze a thin stream of milk from her breast, he wasn't satisfied. She offered him a stick of sugarcane to chew. He tried to shape his gums around it to suck, found nothing, scowled, then wailed in dismay. He slept fitfully like an old man, bitterly muttering against her in his dreams. He rarely even wet himself, as if he couldn't trust her to keep him clean. She felt the baby didn't like her. In her village, she'd always been well-liked, a wide-cheeked, smiling girl. She'd had plenty of friends, plenty of laughter in her life. She'd never made anyone as miserable as she made this baby. She bent her head over him and cried huge tears. The premature death of her father had disrupted the normal course of things. Now she was ashamed that she'd left her home for the city, ashamed that she'd slept with a man who had lied in saying he would marry her, mortally ashamed that she had a baby and no husband, and ashamed that she didn't know how to make the baby feel good. She felt the mad baby, Ababu, was thinking, how unlucky am I to get this incapable girl for my mother instead of a nice, plump, married village woman? In shame and hunger, she visited the lean-to of her grandmother, a cranky old woman as dry as the sticks of kindling with which she earned her living. The girl put Ababu on the straw mat on the floor of her grandmother's three-sided shelter, smaller than a bus stop. Then she knelt and asked her grandmother's permission to slip away for an hour to the river to wash her clothes and bathe. She bowed her head, knowing the old woman would shout at her, "Why did you bring this unneeded baby upon us? Why didn't you stay in the village? What possessed you to think you would find a better life in the capital? You see? The ruined girl knelt, waiting for the weak blows of the old woman's fists to pummel her shoulders and head, and they did. She took this as permission. She gave a Babu a kiss on the top of his hard, bald head, and she fled. Instead of going to the river and then back to her grandmother's hut, she ran barefoot, straight up into the hills. By dawn, the old woman knew she'd been stuck with the skinny baby, her great-grandson. She also knew this meant the ruin of her feeble subsistence. 12 hours a day, every day, she hiked up the steep hills ringing the city in search of firewood, then practically crawled back down with a pile of sticks, 3 times her own height, piled on her back. She was a human burrow. She and her kind had deforested the city. The government frowned upon it, but it was the only work she knew. Meanwhile, the disappearance of the great forests chased away the rain and further impoverished the soil. The calories the old woman expended to earn the daily 5 birr, the Ethiopian penny, barely translated into a plate of boiled beans to replenish her concave belly at night. The margin of life was so thin that she was just a few calories ahead of staying home and starving to death. She did not have the strength to wear a babu on her back during her desperate scavenger hunt for firewood, nor could she carry him in her arms when she trudged back down into the city at dusk, laden with sticks. So she took the young girl's place on the streets as a beggar, wearing the emaciated ababu in a shawl on her back. She did not have the smooth, pretty face of a young mother to entice handouts or more intimate contact from a tourist or businessman. She was an exhausted old woman. She had asked nothing of the world but a few bites of something at bedtime. For her trouble, she now had this burden. This is the last paragraph now of this section.
Mm-hmm.
Ababu, perhaps 18 months old now, didn't complain or whimper anymore, expected nothing. He looked out from his great-grandmother's back with huge worried eyes in a shrunken head. He weighed nothing. He said nothing. Food came as a great surprise when it arrived. The food came to him straight from the old woman's mouth into his. She chewed up boiled kidney beans twice a day and transferred them into Ababu's mouth. It was his baby food. It was her only food and his. He lay listlessly on her lap and opened his mouth. His dull eyes looked nowhere. She bent over him, pecking and emitting like a mama bird. She liked him well enough, but she doubted he would live.
Thank you so much. That was Melissa Faye Green. Reading from There Is No Me Without You, One Woman's Odyssey to Rescue Her Country's Children, published by Bloomsbury. Melissa is going to be the keynoter at the ASJ conference next month. If you want to know more about the conference, go to asja.org, and you can find out more. And it's a wonderful conference for writers, for journalists, for nonfiction people, mostly. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, Melissa will be with us again to talk more about There Is No Me Without You. Please stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. You know, little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hi, I'm attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, also on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes, Public Radio, KUCI-FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here since the top of the hour with Melissa Faye Green, author of the most recent book of hers, There Is No Me Without You, One Woman's Odyssey to Rescue Her Country's Children, published by Bloomsbury. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Barbara.
Okay, so at the beginning of the show, you talked about how you were going to do a story, and you got an assignment. You went to Ethiopia, and this woman's world unfolded before you, bringing you children and so much else. Talk about then knowing that it was not only an article, it was a book. I mean, how did that evolve for you? Did you just find you had so much material that it couldn't be contained in an article? How did that go?
This all happened. The adoption of our Ethiopian daughter and my writing the New York Times magazine story and then being invited to speak about it and then being sent lots of money from all over the country to direct towards the orphans, which I did. All of this happened while I was supposed to be finishing up my third book, Last Man Out, about the Spring Hill, Nova Scotia mine disaster. This was a problem because I had just gotten completely distracted. I could not spend 1 second on my book about the Spring Hill mine disaster. Certainly part of that was the discovery of the internet and email, so that after 1 second of trying to write a word of my book, I would wonder if someone had emailed me since the previous second. So I was really completely distracted by the children in Ethiopia, by this new project, which was just a magazine story, which I was doing during a break within the book that I was writing. So it just took like a heroic act to make myself finish this book that was, you know, that I had loved for a couple of years, but now wanted to move on from. So that was really hard. I had to go back to my old style of writing longhand and just separate myself from the computer and try to just completely focus on the book about the Spring Hill mine disaster, which was about as far on Earth as you could get from the other story. I'm, you know, a vertical mile underground with white coal miners versus, you know, dancing in this dirt yard in the equatorial sun with a bunch of children, you know. Very different. So I made it through finishing that book. That book was published 5 years ago yesterday, which is to say it was published the day before we bombed Iraq. So that book sank like a stone. My entire book tour canceled. I mean, I was against the war for many reasons, but it certainly made that story disappear. Every single interview, every single appearance, everything just canceled because the whole world changed 5 years ago when we invaded Iraq for no good reason. But it freed me up to think about what I was really interested in, and what I was really interested in was all these children that I had seen over there. I still felt daunted, as I had before the article. It was sort of like, all right, well, I got away with the article without anyone discovering I'm not an epidemiologist, but, you know, they'll find out if I write a whole book. In fact, just as the book was being published, I was interviewed, I guess a couple of weeks before it was published, I was interviewed by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I live in Atlanta, and I was so self-effacing and so humble about my ability to write the book that the article about me appeared, and next to my picture was the headline, was a big, you know, subheading reading, I know absolutely nothing about this subject, says author. I really had gone a little overboard with the modesty, because in fact, by the time I published the book, I knew a lot about it, and know a lot about it now. I now, you know, I virtually subscribe to The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, and I've been, you know, I do know about it now. I no longer apologize for having written about this subject. I do know about it now, and I have seen up close and personal, as they say, how the impact that it has on families. And so it was, as far as deciding to write a book about it, it was really a question of following my heart. It was such an obvious decision, because it was and is the main thing I'm interested in. My problem now is that, now what? I didn't, on one hand, I wanted to get the book out quickly because it felt to me that it was full of urgent news, which is true, it is. So you don't want to be lavishing such extensive care on every adjective, which is my want, if you're trying to relay something, you know, that's an emergency. So, and yet, even as I moved forward briskly, I knew I didn't want it to end, that there was nothing else I wanted to do, and now I'm in this sort of free fall of, can I do that again? The two boys, on the other hand, half the time I now feel like I turned into Mrs. Harrigan with her 500 children. The two boys we brought home last summer were from Harrigan's house. I mean, they're a pair of brothers who were simply not going to get adopted and not going anywhere. Their pictures are in my book, which they are eager to show visitors, because at the time we were finishing the book, I had no idea I was going to be their mother, so their pictures are just kind of in the background of some of the images. So now I have so many children, it's almost ridiculous even to think about writing another book, because it's all I can do to get dinner on the table. You know?
Well, I would imagine your book has influenced so many people to adopt.
It has. The New York Times Magazine story powerfully had that effect also, which I had not foreseen. But by the time, let's see, the magazine article came out in 2002. So by the time the book was published in 2006, everywhere I went in the country, as I traveled to do book talks and visited bookstores, families would come to my readings with the children, and it was often with the children they'd adopted as a result of my New York Times Magazine story.
Yeah.
So that was amazingly cool. On the other hand, I am asked reasonably often by people whether the best humanitarian response to the orphan crisis in Africa is to adopt? And the answer is resoundingly no. That's not a humanitarian response. That's not a good idea. What I tell people is that humanitarian impulse only carries you till about midway through the child's third tantrum, and then that's over. That you're finished with the humanitarian work, and now you're stuck with this kid for the rest of your life. You know, you really only adopt because you want a child or you want another child in your life. That's why you adopt. That's not a humanitarian gesture. But there are humanitarian actions that can be taken. I have a website for the book, which is the title of the book. It's thereisnomewithoutyou.com. It's not a dating service. I can't help anyone there. But if you visit it, you'll see a page on how to help. And I've listed large and small organizations, including little organizations right in the front lines of trying to help care for the children, especially to care for the orphan children where they are. It's not a great idea to uproot children and bring them into orphanages. That's about the worst idea. The best idea is try to help the grandparents and the neighbors and, you know, whoever's available to try to sustain the orphan children where they are without uprooting them. And it's really possible now in the age of the Internet to reach out all the way to folks in the front lines of trying to help sustain these children. A lot of the organizations welcome volunteers if people are able to go over and teach or rock babies or have medical skills or share medical skills. That's all really, really powerful. And then just giving money is life-saving.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Melissa Faye Green. Her book is There Is No Me Without You. And she's the keynote speaker at this year's ASJ conference next month, early in the month. I think the weekend of the 13th? It's that second big weekend in April. And you can go to asja.org and learn more and also go to the conference in New York City and see Melissa and attend panels and all sorts of great stuff. I'm going to ask you what might seem a really silly question because I think I encounter this so much on the show. To you, it may be silly, but so many of the...
Barbara, it's a little hard to hear you. Is there some way to make it a little clearer?
Let me try that. Is that better?
That's a little better, yeah.
Okay. A lot of journalists I talk with seem to be interested in making the move to fiction. And I wonder if with you, I mean, it seems that you've been a journalist all your life and involved in nonfiction. Have you ever felt the impulse to write fiction?
I wrote painfully self-conscious short stories in college, and I wrote, you know, agonizingly self-conscious short stories for a little while after college. But when I turned to nonfiction, it felt as if I could just unleash all of my powers of description and my love of landscape and character and faces and light, that I could just be free with all of those gifts without worrying about how to structure a story. It's always happened when I write nonfiction. It's happened with everything I've written, that something about the story takes me completely by surprise. For example, in this story, Herigwin, the great good foster mother, ends up in prison. This was a surprise to me. if this had been a novel, she would have not ended up in prison. She ended up being accused of child selling and prostituting the children. There were any number of horrible things she was accused of. In fact, the book was due to the publisher on December 31st of 2005, and on December 15th of 2005, Herigwin called me from prison. I had then had to call the editor-in-chief and publisher of Bloomsbury, and, you know, I said, hi, Kim. She said, Melissa, hi, how are you? How's it going? I said, well, the book's going well, but things have gotten a little weird in Ethiopia. So at that point, we didn't even know if we were going to make the book deadline. It just overturned everything. So I think to myself, if I were writing fiction, it would have had a happy ending. All of the children would have found homes. She would still be, you know, sitting at her kitchen table, stirring sugar into her tea while, you know, rocking 16 babies. So then that scares me about what I would do with fiction, because, in fact, in my first book, in Praying for Sheetrock, the hero, Thurnell Alston, ends up in prison. And I didn't mean for that to happen. I didn't want that to happen. I'd started writing about him when he was a law-abiding citizen, and he ended up becoming a public official who took bribes. So I would have given that a happy ending. But not everything has a happy ending. I've been so educated by following the tales of real life, you know? So it always scares me. I think if I wrote fiction, it would all be really saccharine sweet, I'm afraid. I just really don't want anyone to suffer or go to prison, especially if they're my hero of my story.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, a little while ago you talked about being busy, of course, with all of these children.
You know, Barbara, I'm having trouble again.
Still trouble, huh?
Having trouble hearing you a little.
I don't know what to do at this point. I'll talk as loud as I can. Is that better?
No.
No.
I should talk a little slower, I think.
Anyway, okay, let me try to tweak some things here and hope that works. Obligations. How do you find time to write? People with less on their plate have a difficult time. How do you do it?
I hope this isn't aggravating to your listeners. I know you've asked me how I do something. How do I decide what to write?
No, how do you find time?
Oh, how do I find time to write?
Yeah, how do you find time? Because writers typically, with much less on their plates than you have, seem to find trouble finding time.
Okay. Well, it's true. We have 9 children now, which is an absolutely ridiculous number, and I never thought that we would do this, and I was never one of those little girls either that wanted a big family. 3 of the children are either away at school or grown and living on their own, so we do have 6 children at home. But the hardest transition in my life was from 0 to 1. Going from childless to having a baby was stunningly difficult, and I didn't know if I'd ever be able to write or have a conscious thought again or do anything other than stagger around the house completely sleep deprived. And I'm sure some people handle that transition more easily. I mean, I loved the baby. I wasn't depressed about the baby. I adored the baby, but I couldn't figure out how to function. I remember it was about 6 months before I figured how to get my contact lenses in, because I didn't know what to do with the baby. Like, was I supposed to just put her on the floor of the bathroom? My contacts, I was so overwhelmed by that. And then we followed that first baby with a second baby after 3 years, and then a third baby. As long as there were babies or preschoolers around whose little typical day was, as at the Cliff Valley Preschool, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, 9 to 1, Wednesday, Friday, 9 to noon, you know, it's really, really hard to structure a career around those hours. And I did, but it wasn't easy. From the moment the youngest went off to full-day kindergarten, my life changed. And the children we've adopted have all been old enough to go straight into kindergarten or first grade, at the least. Our new guy, Daniel, went straight into 7th grade. So I'm not back. I'm in the trenches in a certain way because there are just so damn many of them. And a lot of them are really good athletes. So we're currently on, among the 6 at home, we've got 5 soccer teams, a track team, and a football team. And the most amazing statistic was, as the winter sports briefly overlapped the spring sports, the 6 children at home were on 11 different teams. So that is the hardest thing in my life, their sports schedules. I don't even like to watch sports. I never even see the important goal or the important basket because I'm sitting there with the New York Times in my lap, you know. And then, in fact, you know, the soccer parents around me will say, just say you saw that one, you know, because the kids are great. So that's hard, but nothing compares to having a baby or preschooler underfoot, I think. So that, I mean, now you know, my office is in the house. I have a home office. There's no commute. And the kids all leave by 8 o'clock in the morning. So I have from 8 in the morning till about 2:45 in the afternoon alone in the house. And that's enough.
Yeah.
I couldn't write longer than that anyway, you know.
So what's next?
I just started a magazine story this week about a really incredibly creative, innovative school for teenage boys on the autism, with autism spectrum disorder. It's just a few blocks from here. With all these children in the house, that's about as far away as I can do research at the moment. I'm actually interested in a story about malnutrition in India, but this is just not the moment to be going to India. We're having a group bar and bat mitzvah for 4 of the children this coming May.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, it was just going to be 3 of the children, and we were calling it the tri-mitzvah, but now we've added, we've added Daniel, who just arrived. So quad mitzvah doesn't sound that good, so I'm just calling it the jumbo mitzvah. So at least for the next 2 months, as I plan the jumbo mitzvah, I will be probably working on the story about the school for autism spectrum kids.
Any last words for the writers listening? Any advice you can offer to help writers who may be stuck in a project or maybe trying to figure out what they should be writing when they have so many things they're interested in, when they want to write fiction, when they want to write nonfiction, when they're all over the place?
My favorite advice, I think the best advice given to writers, appears in the novella by J.D. Salinger called Seymour, An Introduction. And in that book, there are fictional, you know, it's fiction, but the older of the glass children, Seymour, is writing notes to his younger brother, Buddy, about Buddy's efforts to write short stories. And you don't see the short stories. You just see, all you get to see is Seymour's comments on the short stories, which is so much fun to read. And I first discovered these when I was in high school, and I've remembered them all my life. You know, I think there's one that begins, quote, Henshaw woke up with a splitting headache, you know, end quote. And then Seymour writes, Buddy, the first line really threw me off. I just really count on you to kill off all the fraudulent Henshaws in fiction. There just are no Henshaws, you know. But it builds to the greatest and longest letter when Buddy finally manages to write a story that Seymour admires. And Seymour says to Buddy, just remember, Buddy, that you've been a reader far longer than you ever were a writer. You were a reader first. So when you're not sure what to do next, just ask yourself, what do you, Buddy Glass, most feel like reading more than anything in the world? And then he says, basically, just go ahead and write it yourself.
Mm.
And the way my version of that for myself is I picture that I've ordered just the book I've most wanted, the book I couldn't wait for it to be published. And I was so eager, I've ordered it, you know, direct from the publisher, and it's just arrived. It's in the mailbox. And I go out to the mailbox, and here's the nice, you know, brown cardboard box. And in it is the book that I know I'm going to just want to run upstairs, sit down, and start reading. And now I'm you know, I'm peeling open this cardboard box, and what is it? What is that book that I can't wait to read? And whatever it is, I need to just write it myself. So
that's great advice. That's stellar advice, actually, because I think writers often, there's a separation between what you love to read and what you're working on.
Yeah, that would be a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what happened to me with the Spring Hill Mine disaster. For the love of God, who wants to read about the Spring Hill Mine disaster? What was I thinking, you know?
Well, you've been great, and I, along with so many other people, enjoy and appreciate that you've written this book and brought attention to all of these children and have brought homes to so many of them, too.
Thanks. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Barbara.
Thank you. That was Melissa Faye Green speaking to us from the South. And she, as I said, will be in New York in April, keynoting at the ASJA annual conference at the Grand Hyatt Go to asja.org for more information on that. That weekend, there's a lot going on. There's panels all day Saturday, and many going on at once. I think six across, and on writing books, on writing articles, on all sorts of good stuff that writers need to be aware of, agents, screenwriting, publicity, so many things. And the fee's quite reasonable. Sunday, half day, there are longer seminars and workshops going on. And it's a great weekend, asja.org. And Melissa Faye Green's website, again, is, there is no me without you.com, and she has one as well, melissafaygreen.com. Anyway, we are at the end of our time once again, and if you want to know more about the show, you can go to penonfire.com. There you can click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen. It'll take you to the radio page. You'll see the schedule. I promised to update it really soon. But there you can also find your way to the podcast. There's 250 or so podcasts up on this date, which is 3/19/08. And you can listen to them free of charge, 24/7. So much else going on. If you want to be on my weekly email list at penonfire.com, you can click on a link that will add you to the list that I only use for the radio show. I'm going to leave you with a quote now by Elia Kazan, who said, "The writer, when he is also an artist, is someone who admits what others don't dare reveal." Anyway, thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you next time. Most of all, I just don't wanna be free, no.